Grulla Lenska adores Radio Gorgeous. Today, I'm with an actor famous for her brilliant acting career and many things other than that, including her aristocratic family, her gorgeous hair, her passionate marriage to Dennis Waterman, and her fabulous voice. Grulla Lenska, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you, Josephine. I'm delighted to be here, and I want to know where you got the title Radio Gorgeous from.
I was in the bath, and I thought, I love radio, and I love women, and the thing is, I'm always trying to think of a strap line for Radio Gorgeous, but it just says what it is, don't you think?
Fabulous. And it's one of those words that hasn't diminished its value. You know, Nice, pretty, beautiful, awesome, all of those get overused. Gorgeous doesn't. Oh. So, very good choice.
Thank you very much. So I've read your recent biography, My Colourful Life, and you have so much to say. I'm going to pick out some highlights. Firstly, your heritage. Your parents escaped from Poland in the Second World War, and they had to leave everything behind. Mm-hmm. What was all that about?
Well, both my parents come from a high aristocratic background. What you're actually talking about is my mother's side of the family. My father was with the diplomatic corps, and he left Poland before the war broke out. My mother's grandfather's estate, outside of Kraków, was an enormous stately home, and they didn't realise right until the end that they were actually going to have to get out as fast as possible. They were given half an hour. Oh. And I remember my mother saying, in that half an hour, what would you imagine that you would take? At the time, she was 17 years old, you know. This was an adventure. She had no idea what was going to happen. And she took her record collection and all the little bits of jewellery she'd got from her grandmother. She didn't even take one spare pair of knickers. And I remember thinking, you know, now if one was given a half an hour to collect one's stuff, what would you actually take? Probably similar. Photographs. That was the other thing she took. You wouldn't really think of clothes.
No. So how did she escape?
The whole family left by convoy, by cars, driving only at night because they were being strafed by the Germans during the daytime. It was only women, of course, because all the men had either stayed behind or had gone on to fight. So it was of the servants associated with the household. I think there was a groom, a nanny, somebody looking after the older generation, a governess. And I think there were 12 cars, and all the rest were female relatives with children. So, and one of the funny things that my mother said also, that before, when all the women and children started congregating in this house, before it was decided that everybody had to move out, this was the last chance. When an enormous amount of women and children get together, what happens? They all get their period at the same time.
Oh.
And one of my mother's duties was cutting up all the sheets in the house to make emergency sanitary pads.
That's what people used to use, rags. I still don't know how it worked.
Well, that's why it's called On the Rag, isn't it?
Yeah. But had she...
She married my father in Rome after the Battle of Monte Cassino, having spent herself 2.5 years in concentration camp in
Ravensbrück. So they got caught?
No. Well, I mean, they were imprisoned because they were political refugees. They weren't Jewish, as most people think, that it was only Jewish people in concentration camp. They were arrested off the Dalmatian coast, where they had lived quite happily under the Italian government for 4 or 5 years, then taken off to this concentration camp, 2.5 years there, then rescued by General Bernadotte of the Swedish Red Cross, rehabilitated in Sweden. And then before the war broke out, she'd been engaged to an Italian officer, but her mother forbade her to marry him because, in her eyes, the Italians betrayed the Poles to the Germans. So the marriage between my mother and my father was an arranged marriage.
Wow.
To good, high aristocratic families, you know. And it turned into the greatest friendship that lasted forever, even though they didn't stay together as a married couple forever. But they were the greatest, dearest of friends. And it sometimes makes me think that perhaps cleverly arranged marriages, where you actually don't know anything about the person before you get together, and you learn to love and respect and like each other, perhaps was a really good thing for some people.
One of three sisters, you were brought up in northwest London. You loved the limelight as a child, and after school you attended the Webber Douglas Drama Academy, where you had to change your name.
Yes, well, Rosa Maria Laura Leopoldina Monica Ubieska is a little bit too long. A, for a signature, and B, to put up on any billboard, which I was hopefully going to get. I didn't want to completely lose my foreignness. And Rula was made up because it comes from Złota Kula, which in Polish means golden ball, because I had a massive reddish gold curls. And Róża, which is rose. So between Kula and Róża came Rula. Easy to remember. And Lenska, I've just taken out the four middle letters of my full Polish surname.
It's a beautiful name.
Well, it's easy to remember and easy to pronounce.
Stephen Berkoff taught you there.
Yes, he did indeed. He was one of our more flamboyant director teachers at drama school, and we've remained close friends since. And I played a trick on him, which he didn't forgive me for a long, long time. In those days, and I presume still today, teachers and pupils were not allowed to have romantic relationships. Well, in those days, he was stepping out with a very close Polish girlfriend of mine. And on one occasion, she asked me to join them with a friend of his for a foursome. And I said, but he's going to know who I am. He's been teaching me for a year. She said, no, we'll do the full disguise. So wig, false eyelashes, tinted sunglasses, fake nails, strong Russian accent, and completely differently dressed from how I normally am. And we met at this restaurant, and I put my arm out, and I said, my name is Rosa Maria Laura Leopoldina Monika Obieska. I am delightful to meet. And he didn't twig for the whole evening, which I was very proud of. And then, of course, when we finally let him know, he wasn't too pleased, but now we laugh about it.
It's fantastic. It proved that it was your first real role, wasn't it?
I like to think of it that way,
yeah,
yes.
It's great. Now, you say in your biography that, yeah, you're good at foreign accents, but you've had a problem with British regional accents. Do you think that's because you were brought up in a home without kind of hearing those?
I think it's partly that. I think it's also the timbre of my voice and the inflection. Even though I was born here, Polish was de rigueur at home. We weren't allowed to speak English at home, even when we started going to English school, which I hated. I'm very grateful now. And I went to elocution lessons to lose whatever Polish accent I had in the beginning.
So was that Polish? You had that?
Oh, yeah. God. And because, you know, if I tried to speak Cockney, I mean, I think probably the accent's all right, but it just doesn't sound right.
It sounds like Birmingham.
All right, well, there you go. You see, I can't tell the difference. And I try to do Jewish and it goes into South African.
Yeah.
I think a Scottish is rather good, but no, I'm not very good, but
so,
I'm good at
so
European.
You're good at European, what, like anything kind of with someone with dark hair then?
Well, French,
yeah.
You know, for example, the French is very easy to put on. German, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Although German is one of the languages that I'm supposed to speak the best because I did it for A level, but I don't like it. And Italian, I spent a lot of time in Italy, as you probably know if you read my book.
I did.
That, yeah, and Eastern European, of course, you know.
Yeah, do Eastern European, go on, because that's, I love
it. Well, Russian is very back in the throat with a dark L. Polish is much more clipped, and they don't say the, they say the. Hungarian is completely unrecognizable.
Yeah, yeah.
And their cadence in Eastern Europe is very different from...
See, because for us, we put it all into one thing, don't we? Whereas you have got the ear because you've been involved with Poland and Russia, and so you can hear the difference.
Yeah, and it's the melody of the language. I've just recently finished a huge tour of Pygmalion, and this was written in 1911, or first performed in 1914. So the English they used to speak then was very different from what we speak now. They used to aspirate their W's, so what, where, when, why. And we had vocal coaching to teach us, you know, because in those days they really moved their lips and their vowel sounds were slightly different from what they are today. So we really had to work on, we've become much lazier with speech now.
Yeah, we say, I say yeah and you know and all these, yes, whereas before it was much more...
enunciated.
Yes, I mean, you hear the Queen and she was like that in the 1940s.
Or Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, that sounded fake actually, didn't it? I always thought. You left drama school and you were very fortunate, you worked immediately, but one day you went to a party and met a very flamboyant Russian called Krizia Pavlik.
Pavlik Stushnov. He was Russian from origin, but born and brought up in Canada. Extremely flamboyant, extraordinarily unusual looking, white blonde hair, big hooked nose, and he ran a surrealist art gallery in Brook Street. We had a flat in the Fulham Road opposite the ABC Cinema on the first floor, and he knew lots of extraordinary, very famous people. For example, Cat Stevens used to come and play guitar in the evenings, and Anthony Scher, who was at drama school with us, was a regular visitor. And he gave me probably the most unusual and glamorous present I've ever had in my life, which was a white taxi.
Wow.
And instead of taxi, it had Rula written on it.
God, that's glamorous.
And I came down one evening, on the evening of my birthday, and right in the middle of Beaufort Street was this gleaming white taxi tied up with an enormous red ribbon. Oh. Great fun, but, you know, when you're driving big distances, because it hadn't been changed on the inside, so I sat in my little pilot seat and the friends sat in the back and having a good time and drinking and laughing. And every so often, if you stopped at a traffic light, people would jump in the back and say, could you take me to Paddington, please?
So it was a little bit of a hassle then.
It was at times, but yeah. Great fun.
So do you think he educated you in some ways then?
He was, you know, all my life I've run after and into danger, excitement, discovery. And he was the first man that I ever lived with. He was, I now think, probably bisexual. Mm-hmm. Extremely theatrical and flamboyant, and great fun to be with. And in no way could I have ever stayed with him longer than I did, which I think was 3 years. A, because he got a little bit dangerous when he drank too much. Yeah. And B, it was a very bizarre lifestyle when he's sold an expensive painting, you know, a de Chirico or a Magritte or a Salvador Dali, then we lived like kings and queens and tramp every night and champagne. And then, you know, a month after all that had gone, it was beans on toast. Yeah. So.
I think that's called being young, isn't it, really?
It is. You know? And, you know, I was just out of drama school then and a jobbing actress, you know, working wherever I could all over the place.
Fabulous, fabulous. I just want to say one more thing. He did take you to Cadaqués and you did meet Salvador Dali.
Can you tell us about that? Yes. Well, Salvador Dali, out of the surrealist artists that he dealt with, Magritte and Dali were my favourites. A lot of them, the others, I didn't really understand and didn't have much time for. So I was thrilled when he told me that we were going to go to Cadaqués to meet Salvador and his wife.
Gala?
Yes. Who answered, well, no, it's the maid who answered the door, dressed in a snow-white dress, black stockings, white shoes, black sunglasses.
The maid?
That's sparkling, the maid. And the first thing you saw when you walked into the corridor when the door opened was a hand chandelier coming out of the wall. And then we went into the garden where they had the famous Lips sofa and various other extraordinary mobiles made by him. We were served tea by Gala in a tutu. She was 70-odd then, with her hair tied into a bun on the top. And then the great man himself appeared, looking exactly like he does in all the photographs, with the waxed, spindly moustache and the highly arched eyebrows and the cane, beautifully dressed, and manic, completely manic eyes. You know, and stories went around about him and his Ménage à Trois and Quatre and Cinq and Six and all the rest of it. And after about an hour's conversation, he decided that he wanted to show us his bedroom, and he went up a spiral staircase from the middle of a room through the ceiling up into this extraordinary room with a bed bigger than the bed of Ware, wow, with, you know, drapes and beautiful materials and everything. And I was a bit scared of him, I have to say, because yeah, both he and Pavlik were of an ilk.
Mm-hmm. Unpredictable.
Unpredictable, yeah, and dangerous.
Yeah.
But yeah, nothing untoward happened. And
good, good. But what an experience.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think that is...
And I never got his autograph.
Love it, love it.
Then one of the best roles of your life came along, which made you famous. It was a TV programme all about an all-girls band called Rock Follies, mm, with Julie Covington and Charlotte Cornwell, who you'd been to college with. It was such a great success. That must have been fantastic fun.
It was highly memorable even now, although people often say, you know, aren't you sick of people bringing that up, which was, you know, 35 years ago. No, it was a dreamed of occasion, which has never been repeated. And in fact, the way television was used in that series has never been repeated either.
Why was it different than, you know?
They used every technical know-how, a bit like computer-generated films now, except they didn't exist then. So for anybody who remembers the series, the girls, we were really the first Spice Girls of sorts.
Yeah, created for TV, created by somebody. Yeah.
Yes, and also three very different girls who meet in a flop of a musical, and their musical director decides to take them on and turn them into the first female rock band in England. And it was based a lot on truth. So you saw, you know, how cruel and nasty management is, and personal management and agents and people like that.
Especially in those times against women.
Oh, yes. God. And, you know, we were pushed from pillar to post, and our style was changed all the time, you know, from leather-booted, leather-jacketed to sort of 1920s dresses to wartime uniforms. You know, we went through every sort of permutation. We did... The scripts were superb. The music, written by Andy Mackay from Roxy Music, was wonderful, as were the lyrics. And then we had these fantastic fantasy sequences. So every day there were dancing rehearsals, there were acting rehearsals, there were singing rehearsals, and the fantasy rehearsals. And when we used to go into Thames Television to do the fantasy sequences, one of the first ones I remember was for the song Stairway. And they'd built these three enormous white staircases going right up into the rafters.
That's be Barclay, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. But with no, what do you call it, banisters down the sides. Glossy white, dry ice, clouds, everything. And it just disappeared up into the rafters of the studio. And we were in full-length evening dresses, stiletto heels, singing.
Oh, my God.
Harmonising and trying to look elegant, not watching the stairs. It was hard work.
Very hard.
But very
and
exciting.
And just think how dangerous it is. I bet nowadays they'd never do anything that dangerous.
No, probably Elf and Safety wouldn't allow it, would they?
God, so it was glamorous, it was interesting. But then was a second series, and the writers decided to kind of choose Julie Covington because she had it over you two more. And did that cause resentment then?
Yes. Mm. And it was also in the script, of course. So,
oh, wow.
You know, it
was so that must be weird.
Art reliving life, yes, or vice versa. And, of course, our writer, our author, was in rehearsals with us all the time. So he could see there's always problems with a triangle. It's always two against one, except that the sides change. So he used to witness, you know, theoretically, each episode, one girl had sort of more to do. The three storylines, you know, changed from... One week it was Julie, and then in the second series it was more and more Julie. And Charlotte and I got relegated to Harmony Queens. Although we absolutely realised that Julie's voice was the best, and she did have an absolutely stunning voice. Her version of Don't Cry For Me, Argentina still reduces me to tears.
radiogorgeous.com.
It won't be easy. You'll think it's strange when I try to explain how I feel, that I still need your love after all that I've done. You won't be. Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence, I kept my promise. Don't keep your distance. Have I said too much? There's nothing more I can think of to say to you. But all you have to do is look at me to know that every word is true.
Rulalenska adores Radio Gorgeous.
Fellow actor Brian Deacon and had your only daughter Lara in 1979.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was at drama school with me, so we were friends from the beginning and sort of got together a little bit by default. He was the boyfriend of a very, very close friend of both of ours, probably the closest friend of that time of my life, who got muscular sclerosis.
Oh, God.
And then sadly died of dementia. Oh, I mean, very premature dementia.
Oh, my God.
And our friendship sort of changed over the time that we were looking after her and seeing her while she was ill.
So it sort of evolved through caring for her?
Yeah. A little bit, yeah. And a little bit on the rebound from the Russian guy, and he was on the rebound from... Which is not to say that it wasn't a deep and meaningful love. And I ran away from my normal rushing into dangerous situations scenario, because he really was... you know, perfect husband material, perfect father
really
material.
Really decent bloke.
Yes, yeah. And still is, and we're great friends, and he's a wonderful grandfather to our grandchild.
Now, isn't that interesting? You say you're still great friends. It's the same as your
mother did. The same as my mother, yeah.
That's really interesting. So actually he came into your life to be a good person, didn't he?
And a lifelong friend.
Yeah. Fantastic. But then, when your daughter was about two, you met child star and very successful actor Dennis Waterman, famous for Sweeney and Minder, and you suited each other so well, both actors, both redheads, both successful. You say that there were warning signs at first that he was a philanderer, but you ignored them and followed your heart.
Yeah, I not only followed my heart, but stupidly, like a lot of women, believed that he was what he was. You know, a heavy drinker and a womanizer and rough diamond with a heart of gold, because he had never been properly looked after and loved and nurtured and cherished, which is very big-headed, but a lot of women feel that way. We were chalk and cheese in a lot of other ways, completely different social backgrounds.
Yeah.
He, by his own admission, much preferred the company of men, adored having a woman on his arm, and he was a wonderful romantic or romanticist. Actually, there's a difference. And we fell madly, crazily, passionately in something, lust, love, call it what you will. I suppose forbidden fruit always tastes sweeter as well.
Because he was married, was he?
He was married then to his second or third wife. I can't remember. I found out that there'd been another wife even before that one. And he had two young kids, and I fully, you know, hoped that it wasn't going to last. I didn't want my marriage to break up. Mm. We had a beautiful little daughter, but somehow it's just I wasn't strong enough to say no. And we had 16 years together.
That's such a long time.
It is. And 9 of them were wonderful.
Great.
Absolutely wonderful, which people forget about.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, when it went rotten, it went seriously, cruelly, horribly, publicly.
Yes.
Vitriolically rotten.
Now, that's what I want to talk about, because you said in the book you're the Posh and Becks of kind of the 80s. I mean, in what way? Were you in the tabloids all the time?
Yeah, well, we were a sort of golden couple to start with, which the British press are very good at.
Yes.
Unlikely matching, you know, daughter of a countess and son of
a
railway ticket collector and all of that sort of stuff. Mm. We worked together very well. We did, you know, 4 years of doing exclusive two-handers in the theatre, travelling all over the world.
Good God, that's so intimate.
And
day
fantastic.
And night.
Yeah, 24-7.
Yeah.
I suppose looking back on it now, there wasn't a deep friendship because we had completely different values. You know, he loved being in a bar with his mates for hours on end. He had his own charity football team, occasional cricket team, which then descended into golf. He was a wonderful raconteur, a great party person, a great boozer, and a great womanizer, and had enormous amount, and a fantastic musician and a great actor and all the rest of it. Not terribly good with children, didn't really have any gifts as a father.
Sounds like he might not have had time.
Well, partly that, but I mean, it just wasn't in his upbringing.
No,
he was the last
he was a child star,
last
as well.
Of 8 children, and not with a loving family background.
What,
you know?
What age did he become famous?
I think he was about 11 or 12 when he played.
Because remember, they say
Dennis
that the
Menace,
day
it?
I love it. They say that the age you become famous is the age you stay at. So,
oh really?
Yeah.
Oh, I've never heard that before.
So he was an 11-year-old. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does. In lots of ways, that does. Yes, it does.
But because he liked his friends, his mates, playing. He was always playing, wasn't he?
He was. Yeah. And he, you know, he loved being the centre of attention. And in fact, the roles that he became famous for were him.
Yes.
You know, he was the rough diamond with a heart of gold.
The Jack the Lad.
Yes. Yeah. And adored by the British press and the British public. And by women, absolutely adored. And he could be, you know, he was one of the hellraisers like Richard Harris and Peter O'Toole. They could get away with murder, and they did.
You escaped from a relationship because he was having a long affair. You bought a house. You had a gorgeous house with him, a gorgeous, was it five bedroom?
Seven, actually.
Seven bedroom house.
Well, it had a guest annex above the snooker room. So it was a beautiful, not grand, but a beautiful house in the country in Buckinghamshire. Ideal. You know, now
bringing your family up because
did the
girls, his girls, or whatever,
they were with us an enormous amount of time. They travelled with us to Australia, New Zealand, Africa, whether it was work or holiday related. My daughter and his youngest daughter were the closest of friends. That was the other thing that was very, very painful for her was, you know, when all contact was severed forcibly, when it all split, it was public.
What year was that then?
1995.
Okay.
The year they did my This Is Your Life, the year my parents died.
Wow.
It was the year from hell, really,
oh
the year from hell.
Oh, my God.
I mean, we didn't actually divorce till 98, but 95, things started going badly wrong. And then he ran off to Australia.
With the woman.
With another woman. Yeah. And, you know, that was all pretty well documented in the press. And the press didn't help because they just made things worse, and British press are famous for that.
Yeah.
You know, they'd love shooting you down once you've been up there.
Yeah.
So it was a very tough time. I'd never really been on my own. And the press were relentless, and they wanted photographs, and they wanted reasons, and they wanted the explanations. And I kept running away and saying, no comment, no comment, no comment, for an awfully long time. And then I made the mistake of... Under the advice of agent and lawyer at the time, they said, you know, the press are going to carry on following you around unless you say something to somebody. So I had decided, and at the time I was renting here in Chiswick, and then an unscrupulous newspaper person arrived on my doorstep one evening under the guise of an old school friend. My daughter was at home from boarding school at the time.
Oh.
Opened the door to her, and it was a social editor of one of the tabloids who scotched the story by putting words into my mouth, basically. Anyway, long, complicated situation, which made the whole breakup much, much worse. And then the lawyers got hold of it, and it just went from bad to worse.
It was the worst advice you'd ever been given.
And terrible.
Your charities are very close to your heart, mm-hmm. especially Children in Crisis, and you tried to find a way of raising a large sum of money fast. And your agent rang and contacted you and said, how about doing Celebrity Big Brother? Luckily, you did not know much about it when you said yes.
Well, unluckily.
Yeah.
But actually, it didn't start with that. It started with Strictly Come Dancing, which is what I really wanted to do.
Mm.
And then unfortunately, you know, because they interview lots and lots of people and then they try to fill certain brackets, criteria. Yes. So as the sort of older woman, that had been filled beforehand. So I didn't get it. And this agent said, how about Big Brother? I said, over my dead body, no way. And then they said, you know, A, you get paid very well, but B, the big carrot on the stick was a very, very large sum of money guaranteed to your favourite charities. And I'm talking, you know, many thousands. As I say, luckily or unluckily, I knew very little about the programme.
Yeah.
For example, I didn't know that men and women were going to be sleeping in the same dormitory, so to speak.
God.
I did know that you were likely to be on camera all the time.
Yeah.
And I did know that you were not allowed to take your microphones off apart from night time when there were microphones hanging above your bed anyway. And I didn't realise that you had nothing to do apart from the tasks set by Big Brother. So after the first two or three days, you know, when you find out what you have in common with other people, and you know, there's nothing to read, there's nothing to write with, you have no idea of time.
You said that you didn't yet took all your clocks away.
Yes, everything, all timepieces.
So what does that feel like?
Well, you're at the mercy of... It's like George Orwell's Big Brother. You're at the mercy of this machine. If they didn't want you to know whether it was light or dark, they brought the shutters down outside.
So do you think it kind of broke people down?
Of course it did. And then, apart from food and drink being taken away from you if you didn't do the tasks properly. I mean, there were 2 days when we literally had nothing to eat but potato peelings, which is like concentration camp. Then they would confiscate tea and coffee. And have you any idea what that does to people?
Yeah.
When you take away their caffeine fix.
Grumpy. Very grumpy. Mm.
And then you had a big responsibility to the group, because if you failed in any of your tasks, you weren't individually punished. The group was punished. They used to control the temperature. There was one toilet and one shower between 11 people.
Oh. There were three people in there that gave an amazingly interesting triangle. Can you tell me who they were?
Michael Barrymore, ex-comedian, at that time on a murder charge, ex-alcoholic and drug addict. So very nervy.
Yeah.
For the first 2 or 3 days, when he was the centre of attention, he was fine. He was also obsessive-compulsive to a certain extent. Extremely funny, terribly clever. Then you had George Galloway, what he was doing in there as a Member of Parliament, God only knows anyway. Hugely intelligent again. I had an enormous amount of respect for him in the beginning, and in fact my heart lifted when he came in, because I'd followed him on War on Want, and he always seemed to me that he was the hero of the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, was my opinion changed in there. And Pete Burns, probably the most famous. Well, he didn't like being called a transvestite, and he wasn't a transsexual.
No.
He was...
He's famous, I suppose, for plastic surgery, really.
Yes, and unique and extraordinary looking.
Was he an interesting character as well?
He was, again, highly intelligent and frightening, very opinionated and very bitter.
Oh, no.
Carried an enormous...
I wonder what about? I mean, if you go...
I don't know. And then, you know, there were three young pop stars who I didn't know at all. There was Dennis Rodman, who is a 6'6" or 7" tall baseball player from America, so studded and tattooed that you couldn't understand a word he said. Lovely Faria, one of Sven Goran Eriksson's girlfriends.
Chantel,
who was a complete unknown, of course, put in by the Big Brother house.
From Preston,
who ended up marrying her.
Yeah.
Jodie Marsh.
That's it, Jodie Marsh, who's a weird-looking person.
And then, it's very pretty then,
yeah.
But that was the first time that I saw how cruel Pete Burns and Galloway could
jealous.
Be.
Jealous.
They jumped down her throat.
I bet they were jealous. Because I bet Pete Burns was jealous of her looks, because she's so pretty, as you said.
I don't know what it was, but those three... Galloway, Barrymore and Burns became the sort of leading lights.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, they became very close friends at times. And the most peculiar coupling towards the end was Galloway and Burns.
I bet.
You know, they used to spend hours well into the night.
What, chatting?
Talking to each other, yeah.
So why did you go off George Galloway?
Because I saw how cruel he could be and how manipulative and clever. And
think that, about it, sounds like a politician.
Not in a warm way.
No. I mean, it must be... I mean, very interesting. Again, your mum's been, I shouldn't say a concentration camp, but...
There were smacked up moments of that and prison and boarding school and all of which I've experienced, so I know what I'm talking about. I upheld the things that mattered to me, like when Pete Burns's coat was discovered, you know, which he claimed was gorilla.
Yeah.
Black and white gorilla,
That was massively in the newspaper.
Yes, and the police nearly raided the Big Brother house. But, you know, they knew, because they go all through your luggage, so they knew exactly what was in his suitcase.
Yeah, it was a story again, wasn't it?
But I made, you know, there's no greater joy than to write huge cheques to charities that I've followed and supported for many years and which I'll never be able to do again. So that more than made up for whatever difficulties.
You've always been a working actress in film, theatre and stage, but you've also been more recently in Coronation Street. I can't believe it.
I know, I couldn't believe it when it was first talked about.
So can you tell us about your role and what's it really like on the street, Corrie?
I'm not a great soap watcher. Of course, I knew about Corrie because it's iconic and it's been on for 50 years. When my agent first rang and he said, you know, I think originally it was something like 6 or 7 episodes. And I said, you know, unless there's a proper storyline, much as I would love to do a stint in Corrie, I'm not really interested in, you know, just 5 or 6 scenes. The possibility of the part being written up was talked about. I did my 3 or 4 episodes, introduced into the series by Nigel Havers, who was my sort of toy boy escort.
So you were kind of posher people in Coronation Street?
Slightly, yeah. Yes. Yeah. But although I was also a hairdresser. Not to say that there aren't posh people
who
are hairdressers.
But I know what you mean, yeah. You had to have a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then...
Who were you meant to be then? And what was your accent?
I'll tell you that in a minute. So her name was Claudia, and she was a hairdresser friend of Audrey's, you know, who's been a stalwart of Corrie for a long, long time. How they'd become friends, where they'd met, and how long they'd known each other wasn't written in, so we made it up for ourselves. And Sue and I luckily hit it off and became very close friends. One of the biggest fears about those programmes is when you come into a cast full of people who've been doing it, some of them 50 years, but lots of them, most of them regulars, and there is no rehearsal. I mean, it is done incredibly fast. They're shooting 3 or 4 episodes at the same time on different sets with different directors. So you really have to keep on top of your own storyline because you film things out of sequence. Mm. The first line that I was due to say, which I've never ever heard anybody say, was the cleanliness in these toilets is second to none. I mean, can you imagine anybody, apart from maybe Margaret Thatcher, saying something like that?
So you obviously were a bit, they wanted to come
across... I was a bit toffee-nosed.
Yeah, exactly, a bit snooty. Yeah.
But my agent said to me, you know, if they are going to keep you in long term, might be an idea to try a sort of slightly posher Yorkshire accent. Now, Yorkshire's one of my worst.
Yeah.
So I kept practising it in the mirror and looking it up on the BBC accent website. And then I arrived in Granada and I met up with Sue, I mean, minutes before we were due to go on to do the first scene. And I said, darling, can I just try out my Yorkshire accent on you? So she said, oh, go on. So I said, oh, the cleanliness in these toilets is second to none. She said, no, take it down just a little bit, you know, just a twinge. Well, the cleanliness in these toilets is second to none. She said, no, 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 stick to your own accent. So I thought that I was putting in the odd twinge, but apparently I didn't. It stayed, you know, the relationship...
How long were you in there, then?
1.5 years,
wow.
On and off. But it was a very unusual love-hate relationship between two older middle-aged ladies.
That's fun.
Which was great, yeah, and we sparked off well, and it was written well. Mm. And I had, you know, several unforgettable lines, like, betrayed by the tranny and the granny. Because I was stepping out with a transvestite who I didn't know was a transvestite, and then he confided in her. Great stuff.
What a lot.
Great stuff.
Where did they put you up in a hotel when you're there, then?
Mm. Yeah, well, you have to find your own, but yes.
But they're expensive, yeah. And what is the street? Is it a great place to work?
A fantastic place. Oh. I mean, you know, it's a huge studios and there are sets, obviously, that are up all the time for the characters' houses and The Rover's Return. And, it was very, very strange feeling being on there and in there.
Yeah, something that you do know and you have seen, even if you haven't watched it a lot in your life, it's been in the background.
Yes, and all those iconic people in it, you know. It was lovely. It was a great experience. Really, and something I'm very proud of, you know, to have been in something like that.
Yes, I think so. Really good. And also, the great thing is you did, you know, you could be a little bit of a, you could be ruler in there as well.
A little bit, yes.
Now let's talk about your daughter. We've mentioned her a little bit, but she got married and you're a grandmother. And tell me about, have you got a grandchild? Is it a boy or a girl?
A little boy. He's now just coming up for 2.5. And I'm indescribably, passionately, madly in love with him. I think probably every grandmother is. And never having had anything to do with little boys. My own child is a daughter, and Dennis is children were girls, and it is a completely different thing. And she is a wonderful mother, quite structured and quite disciplined, and he's a bright cookie and very funny. And the other day, she texted me the other day, for example, saying, very proud mummy moment, Ethan got himself completely dressed on his own today. I said, so what did he choose to wear? She said it was amazing. It was all colour coordinated. So monster knickers, yellow shorts and a yellow and lime green T-shirt with Buzz Lightyear on it. And he was very proud of himself and she was very proud of him. You know, snippets of information which you relive like with your own child.
Yes.
And I can still never get past this miraculous feeling of watching this little thing, which is the child of my little thing. You know, yes. No matter how old you are, yes. You still think of your children as mm-hmm. your little kids.
Rula Lenska, actress, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. My Colourful Life is published by the Robson Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Josephine. It's been an absolute joy. RadioGorgeous.com